So my argument is that if the evolution means just spreading your DNA as far and wide as you can, yeast domesticated humans. They got us to work for them and shoot their DNA off way into outer space.
We could be yeast, actually, because the family tree, we're closer.
We could be yeast. We're
closer to yeast than lactobacillus, so, like bacteria. So we could be yeast, you know?
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Kentucky Commons Radio Hour. I am Michael Moeller, joined today by John Renane.
Hello.
David Satterley.
Hey.
We are not at Brewgrass Homebrew Supply in Louisville. We are at White Labs in Asheville, North Carolina. Also joined by Pablo Gomez, the technical account manager for the Southeast and Latin America, and Devin Tawney, the education coordinator. Devin, Pablo, thanks for coming on and inviting us in.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, this is going to be a good conversation. This is going to be a little bit, you know, I don't want to say a heady conversation, but we're going to be talking a lot about, like, you know, yeast and how that, you know, affects what we usually like to drink. We want to learn all about what you all do here at White Labs. But first, we're going to do a traditional beer share that we always like to do. David has a beer for us.
Great.
Yeah, we wouldn't show up empty-handed ever. So we did bring you one of our favorite beers from our home state of Kentucky. This is a Kentucky Common Ale. Have you all... You've had Kentucky Commons before?
I've tried it before.
I love a Kentucky Common with the rye bill. Oh my God. Oh, so good.
You got it. So this is from Dreaming Creek out of Richmond, Kentucky. It's about, I don't know, 75 miles away from us, but this is always a good one to share and to have around. They do such a good job with it. So I'm interested to see what you all think of it.
Yeah, it's a good style. It's a style that we like to try to talk about because, you know, being in Kentucky, obviously things... When the first thing that people think about is bourbon. I think the Kentucky Common is a very special recipe and that we can own and should own a little bit more. So whenever we like to travel, we like to bring it with us to just kind of, you know, preach that gospel of Kentucky Common.
Ooh, a crushable rye.
Crushable rye.
There's a long-standing debate in the, you know, annals of Kentucky Common history. You guys are kind of in the yeast world. Sour or unsour, if you're thinking about the historical style for Kentucky Common?
I've mainly heard it was sour. I've always heard it was a mixed culture,
right? Yeah.
Because you're using a lot of like the rye malt and everything. So, but I've never had it as a mixed culture with that slight acidity. I've always mainly had it on a homebrew scale, and that's where I fell in love with it.
When we brew it with folks in the shop, we either just use your all's California yeast or sometimes like the cream ale blend. That's what we most commonly use.
Yeah, that's what I know too, yeah.
But I was looking through your all's catalog this morning. I want to try it with the Kentucky bourbon yeast because the story goes that like really it was sour sometimes, but that's probably because they would age it in like pine pitch barrel lined casks back in the day. So even if they thought they were getting a pure pitch of yeast and it was supposed to be, you know, a clean finishing dark cream ale, a lot of times it probably ended up with some funk in there after sitting in those barrels. But I want to try it with that bourbon yeast.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting.
So as we're enjoying these beers, can you just both give us a little bit of an overview of what you all do for White Labs?
I'm a technical manager. Like you said, I have the Southeast territory, Latin America. You know, I'm originally from Argentina, I guess makes sense to say that. And basically, you know, it's visiting breweries, helping them with anything related, you know, with fermentation, you know, yeast management. But also, you know, as other part of the job that I do is like also help not only my territory, but in the whole, you know, all our customers, you know, when anything goes a little above what, you know, our customer service team can handle, you know, it comes to me and that's kind of one of the things I do daily.
Devin?
Yeah. How I started, I actually started as a lab tech. So, I worked in the yeast lab as well as our analytical lab in San Diego. So that's a third-party TTB certified lab. So I'm a scientist by heart. And then eventually from that, I moved into R&D, did a bunch of R&D for White Labs and presented at MBAA ASBCs. And they're like, hey, you're really, really good at talking and presenting. So they actually moved me to marketing. So now I'm part of the technical education coordinator. I do a bunch of workshops, such as we do workshops here at White Labs called Yeast Essentials.
And then I'm also giving talks at MBA, ASBC, but also making sure all our collateral, our blogs and stuff are technically sound and scientifically correct.
And we're actually filming and recording this today in the lab that you are here for. I mean, you're coming in from San Diego to conduct some studies here.
So pretty much this lab, as you could see, is more of like a, almost like a university lab. Of it's very open, it's very spacious to allow students to come in and get hands-on training of how to use a microscope, how to get certain QA/QC parameters for getting better yeast handling, better quality control on their beer. So that's what we're trying to do, is help educate consumers on proper yeast management.
And certainly we want to share with our listeners kind of the history of White Labs. You guys have been around for a long time, but maybe before that, I at least always come from a kind of a homebrewer's perspective. Do you guys have personal stories? It sounds like, you know, maybe you were more into science and then got into beer, or more into beer and science. Do you guys kind of both have a short version of how you kind of got into this whole crazy world? What came first, the science or the beer?
For me, the beer. Then I found that fermentation was the part that I enjoyed the most out of, you know, the whole brewing process. But for me, it started by, you know, home brewing, early 2000s. And I was living in Miami at the time. And I had to order yeast. There was now a homebrew shop around. And I had to order yeast, you know, from who knows where. And it happened that, you know, the first yeast I ordered was a liquid yeast, and it was White Labs. So, you know, I stick at the time, right? You were like, you're either brew with or ferment with White Labs or White, right? That was like kind of like, and you stick, you used to stick with what, you
know. Or that, like, who knows how old pack of Fermentis that's like on a strange pack or like shelf in like liquor barn or something.
I started homebrewing, and because, you know, my first language is Spanish, I got in contact with the Cicerone program, and I kind of started helping them, you know, doing some edits, you know, on the, when they were like translating their some of their programs. And I did a little bit of that with the Simer G magazine for American Homebrew Association. And yeah, and then that's how it kind of started.
Nice. That was totally the opposite route, Pablo. Like, I did science first. I always loved food science. Like, I'm a huge Good Eats aficionado.
Yeah, and Alton Brown, shout out. Yeah. That was one of the first videos I ever watched, was his homebrewing video that got me interested in it. Amber Waves of Grain way back in the day.
I need to go watch that, actually.
It's good.
Okay. But yeah, I always love food. So I did chemistry, and I did some biotech in San Diego, and it just wasn't for me. It was a lot of grueling, long hours of doing pipette work. So I wanted to get back into food science, and luckily for me, San Diego was a huge mecca. Food science was craft beer. So I actually did a certificate, brewing certificate at UCSD Extension. Luckily enough, some of the big dogs were teaching those courses. So like Stone, Ballast Point, all that were teaching those courses. So I was able to get a foot in the door. I actually interned at Carl Strauss. And then from that, I never stopped. Of like, okay, I'm going to be food science, but QA/QC lab stuff for breweries, because that realm, and just talking about beer, it's art form and science, and it's combined and meshed so perfectly well.
And so it sounds like you guys kind of are the perfect like amalgamation of like what White Labs represents. We talk a lot about kind of the history of the craft beer movement and beer in general on this show. You know, beer is, I think, the oldest beer they found at this point is like from like the Natufian caves in like Israel, Palestine area. It's like 13,000 years old. People have been doing this forever, and it's always been known it's some kind of cereal grain. It's usually some kind of herbaceous plant, most commonly these days hops, water. And in fact, if you ask like the Germans, like via the Reheimsgebot, like yeast wasn't even mentioned as an ingredient historically. Louis Pasteur, I think, started figuring that stuff out. But, you know, craft beer, a lot of people just associate it with like the hops and the malts and all that kind of stuff. But as you were saying, yeast is the most important part. Yeast is kind of the magic ingredient. And to me, White Labs was the company, when I found out about it, that's kind of when I opened my eyes to the whole world of yeast. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the ethos behind how White Labs started and kind of how you guys carry that forward just with promoting, you know, all things fermentation and yeast?
Yeah, well, it's right. I think both are correlated, right? Like, you know, starting as a scientist, starting because you like beer, right? It's about, you know, we love this, we love the industry, right? And so, you know, same as with Chris White, right? He is passionate about, you know, this industry. And that's how we started, you know, 1995, you know, he happened to be on the right place, San Diego, right, at the right time, meeting the right people, right, when he was starting, like, you know, in college, he was starting homebrewing, became friends with two guys who were, like, they own a homebrew shop in San Diego at the time, Homebrew Mart. And they happened to be, like, developing recipes because their dream was to open a brewery. They ended up opening Ballast Point.
Nice.
basically, Chris learned, and the, you know, the three of them, right, Jack, and Chris, you know, they all learned together. And basically, for what they said is, like, you know, they start asking Chris, why don't you, you know, is anything you can do, you know, with what you're studying, you know, have you done anything with yeast? And that's when Chris got more into, you know, the, to see what was available, right, at the time. And I think the first big innovation Wild Labs did, you know, through Chris, was creating the first pitchable yeast in the industry, right? Before Wild Labs, you could get the liquid yeast, but it was not concentrated the way it is nowadays, right? Kind of the race of who got the best yeast kind of, like, start pushing labs to concentrate more and more and more every year. But at the time, right, that's when starters became popular, right? Because if you will not make a starter, that, you know, when you buy liquid yeast at the time, it was not enough yeast to you know, to brew your, to ferment your beer. So I think that's the first thing Wild Labs did, and concentrate the yeast in a way that, you know, you could, you know, pitch it right, you know, into your bucket or whatever you were, like, fermenting at the time. But really humble beginnings, as Chris and Lisa were telling me too, like, you know, one of the first customers was Big Support in San Diego. And they were trading yeast for pizza in the parking lot at the beginning. But, you know, it's about the passion. It's about, you know, try to be better. And that's what we've been doing since that year.
And I think one of the things that's really interesting about what you all do as well, and you were one of the first to do this, I mean, you guys do your classic California strains, and I'm sure that's kind of what it was in the beginning, but you guys really have done a lot of, you know, research. And, you know, these days when we go sit down to order all of the different strains of yeast for our homebrewers in the shop, I can be like, hey, we literally have these yeasts that come from all of these different brewing regions all over the world. What does that process look like? How do you guys find those different strains? And, you know, you can get the Hefeweizen strain from, you know, northern regions of Germany, or you can get your alls like Bavarian Wit. What does that look like? How do you guys, you know, find these things and bring them back here to be able to identify and culture them, keep them going for brewers and homebrewers alike?
Yeah, well, a lot of that yeast collection is, what's funny is yeasts have been domesticated for so long, they're almost like wolves to dogs. So find them naturally occurring doesn't happen as often, but there's so many yeast banks around the world, and Dr. Chris White's done a bunch of collections as well. So we have a minus 80 cryogenically freezer that we store all these different yeasts. So we not only provide like 80 core strains year round, but we have so many hundreds more in the bank that we just like found, maybe swabbed from old shipwrecks.
Yeah.
We brewed someone's beard before, and like they made a beard beer, which is interesting. But yeah, yeast is everywhere. Organisms are everywhere. Yeah. But what's crazy is just, again, that strain variety of almost, you have your golden retrievers, you have our poodles. There's so many different varieties out there, but each are unique in its own characteristic, almost like how each dog looks completely different. And that's something we like to highlight and really showcase and provide that experimentation, because going back on the homebrewing, that's like where our love comes from, is that experimentation of like, hey, choose a different hop, choose a different malt, choose a different yeast strain, and like have fun with it. Like there's guidelines, but there's no like set rules. So you could always try something new, try something different, and see what comes out of it.
Yeah. And also traveling, right? Like for example, I was able to get samples and when visiting, cachaceria in Brazil, or going to Mexico and a tequila area, right? Like, you know, you ask, you know, they're fine, you know, mostly those type of, beverage to like natural fermentation, but that's how you get that, and then you send it to the lab, and then we all get counts like, what is in there, right? And we start finding things, and so it's a little bit both worlds.
I think one of my favorite stories too is like we actually partnered with Illumina, which is a huge genetic sequence bio company in San Diego back in 2013. And we were able to genetically sequence 96 of these strains. So we almost did like a 23andMe or Ancestry.com and got like the different full genome sequence to see like these different clades of like, oh, these came from Britain, these came from Germany, these
That's
genes
awesome.
Are Holy similar. Crap. And then we had fun with it. So like usually every October we come out with a Frankenstout, which we just pitch all 96 strains in at once. And
it what becomes, does it taste like?
It's an interesting beer. You got Belgian notes, phenolic.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But it's fun, you know?
One example that I remember that I thought was super interesting, and my show notes are on my phone, which is filming us right now, but it was the extinct plant, the cacao plant that was in South America. Is that correct? Or Central America?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Do you guys remember the story of how you all, because it was thought to be gone, and you guys were able to cultivate the yeast from inside of the flower of the plant? Is that what I'm remembering?
I believe something like that. I was not currently involved with that project.
Was it Marignan?
Marignan.
Yeah,
Marignan.
Yeah, that's it. Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was more related to a person who was from, I think from, I'm not 100% sure, but I think from around Peru. This person like found this, you know, yeast strain in some of the flower of this cacao and brought it here to the States, and he worked with us kind of like in order to kind of like see what it could do basically. Yeah. But it's some sort of like what I try a beer was like, I would say we'll give you a some sort of like saison type of you know, character to the beer.
It's pretty phenolic, so maybe like a chocolate hef or something would be good with it.
Yeah. You guys sent us a little pitch of it. I think we did a class. I can't remember if it was with Fall City or Against the Grain, but we did like a dark saison basically, and we used that in there. And even before we ended up putting it on some cacao nibs, but it actually had like a little essence of cacao kind of in that, like the back of the phenol range that I don't know. So that was just to me when I was like, man, White Labs is fucking cool. Like, it's so crazy that you guys go all over the world and do these things, which otherwise we just wouldn't have access to. They would just disappear into time. And you guys kind of preserve that, which I think is super, super cool.
You mentioned yeast being a little bit like dogs. Are there any like yappy dog yeast that like this is just ridiculous to work with?
Each yeast strain has its own characteristics. The reason why like 001 is like our workhorse and our love child is because of how robust and how many styles it could do and how viable it stays. But yeah, there are many strains out there. You're seeing it, even new strains today of like non-alcoholic beer of using wild yeast of like, each have their own quirks that you just need to learn, almost like training a dog. So each dog could be trained. It's just, you need to learn its flocculation characteristics or how much it attenuates and all those small details.
And this is coming a little bit from my own ignorance, but yeast mutates as you use it over time. Is it the bank that kind of sets that at the ground level and you pull from that every time?
Yes. So a lot of our bank is cryogenically frozen, almost like Walt Disney, right? Minus 80 Celsius.
Almost.
But what's nice is, yeah, you're barely taking any yeast to start propping it up. And we're able to prop that up in 21 days with 30 quality checkpoints to make sure our yeast are robust, clean, ready to ferment those beers. There are brewers that have gone multiple generations over time. Maybe they lose some characteristics, maybe they lose some flocculation things, but they are asexually budding. So it is the same yeast cell that's creating clones of itself. So over time, yeah, you might see some variation, but to get that consistency back, at least we have that frozen in time piece that you could restart and reuse every single time.
Yeah. Does White Labs ever just like receive packages from random strangers with swabs, like swab kits in the mail? Like, hey, you should check this out.
Yes, actually we do a bunch of like yeast banking. And we house private strains. It is confidential, but yeah, people do send us stuff and they're like, hey, I actually want to bank this yeast strain because I like what it is, what it does, and we bank it for them.
Yeah, it even makes sense. Sometimes we recommend that to people when, you know, mostly on mixed fermentations, right? You know, that will change pretty quickly, right? And we always recommend to people when you think it's at its peak, right? Like you really love this beer, how it's fermenting, you know, send us a sample, we'll bank it, keep it as it is, right? In the cryogenic freezers, and then keep going, you know, and if anything changes, well, it will change, but but it changes in a way that you don't like, you can always come back to the point when you liked it. So that's really cool.
That's so cool. And another thing that I've heard of you all doing before is especially supporting the community of brewing is you can send in, you know, a sample for analysis and you all will run it through a gamut of tests and determine all sorts of quality checkpoints there. That's a service that you all do?
Yeah. So we have multiple services like that. We do try to do bundle packages. All that testing is actually done in San Diego. So that's our analytical lab. That's somewhat my pride and joy just because that's what I used to supervise and manage. And that's where I started. But yeah, we have a bunch of different quality, high-level instruments, such as gas chromatographs, HPLCs. We have an alkalizer. So we have a plethora of tests that anyone could do. Or anyone could test for. So a lot of times we get finished beer and processed beer, but not only beer, but RTDs, kombucha, wine, ciders. So we test anything and everything as much as possible. And I like to call it like the forensics lab of like, we get to help troubleshoot people's problems and, or like maybe double check if they're hitting a certain baseline or standard that they're aiming for. So it's always a new day in the analytical lab because you never know what samples are coming in, what you have to test.
Yeah.
Pardon my ignorance here, but are there any, you know, universal mysteries in the yeast world that you like maybe are a little bit closer to getting solved than before? I mean, what's a puzzle right now?
I feel like what's always been a puzzle is just, again, that even with that full genetic sequence, you could have genotypes versus phenotypes of like the gene could say something, but the way it's reflected or like shown on the outer appearance could be different. So it's almost like having a gut biome or like a mixed culture of like, although you might be changing one thing, you could be really affecting something else or like taking away for something else. So everything's in a like a harmonious balance. But yeah, we are seeing more and more like mixed culture stuff or just even like co-fermentations of not even wild things, but two yeast strains and people trialing that.
Yeah, metabolic processes are very complex, right? So, you know, that's why every strain is unique, right? Because they all have their own way, path and way of, you know. So I think like nowadays, the like creating blends has a lot of potential. I think that, you know, I think the industry in the future should keep on looking at that because, you know, by creating the right blend, that's a lot that we've been doing, you know, lately. And I think you can create unique beers with different characters and using the same strains we know today, right?
One of the things that we always like to do on this show is take a little bit of a break in the conversation for Underberg. We call it a Berg break. They have been great friends of the show, so we'd love to share some with you if you're willing.
Yeah, sure.
All right, we'll just pass them down here.
Are you guys Underberg fans?
Love it.
I love Underberg, so I'm a huge fan.
That's what we like to hear.
At least it's not 8 a.m.
Yeah, you're right. It's only 11:22 a.m.
It's 8 for me, you know?
Oh, there you go.
Okay, there you go.
We had really, really delicious, incredibly good, authentic, spicy Mexican food for dinner last night. So we were all like, morning, are we going to start our days with an Underberg? But we figured we'd wait for you guys.
Yes. All right. Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Underberg.
Cheers.
All right. Now, everybody get your swab kits ready.
Right. Just,
there you go.
How much has that killed?
Before we get too far away from it, did you all have any thoughts about the Kentucky Common?
Love that. Now, you know. Now the Underberg is going to fire. Yeah. But yeah, I like the, you know, the malt character of the beer. And I think it's very easy to drink. So it's complex, but the drinkability is good too. Like it.
And, you know, so we talked a little bit about everything that White Labs does out in the, you know, the brewer's world for yeast and stuff like that. But one of the coolest things you guys do here as well is the tap room and, you know, experience coming and taking a tour and visiting. Premier in that experience to me is what you guys do with the kind of different flights and tastings that you guys are able to do with the facilities that you have here. Now that we've cleansed our palate with a delicious Underberg, you guys have a few samples for us to try that basically kind of represent what we've been talking about, how all these different yeasts are like different breeds of dog. I like that metaphor. We'll stick with it. They each kind of bring their own thing to the table. So you guys are basically here able to control for a lot of the variables of the beer. We talked about water, hops, barley, but then you guys can play around and show what those different yeast expressions look like directly to folks. You guys want to just kind of explain how that works and then maybe talk us through how you would let us like people to experience this tasting experiment?
Yeah. That's honestly my favorite like light bulb moment for a lot of people is when they actually try the beer. It's easy to explain, hey, like this yeast has this nuance or this flavor, but until you actually try it and taste it, that's when you like, get the full picture. What's nice is our White Labs Brew Co. A lot of times we are split batching. So we're actually using it as an R&D lab in itself of yeast could behave one way that we know on the lab side, but by brewing it in a 5-barrel fermenter and seeing how it acts on the like a brewery side, we could really learn more about our yeast strain. So what we're doing is we're making the same base wort. So everything from the hops, the malt, the water are all the same. And we actually split batch them into two different fermenters and put a different yeast strain. So the yeast strain is our variable. So yeah, as you could see right here, we have our alt beers with 029 as well as 036. So
is that Dusseldorf? What's the 036?
Dusseldorf. Yeah, and 029 Kolsch.
Yes, sir. Kolsch and Dusseldorf strain.
We sell the heck out of y'all's 029. That's another one I can hardly keep in stock just because people use it for Kolsches, but then also it gets commonly used for people who can't lager. But I'm not as familiar with y'all's Dusseldorf. I've had it a few times, but not as much. So this will be a very interesting experience for me.
Yeah, and what's nice too is like some of the analytics that we're looking at too, that's all available on whitelabsbrewingco.com. We're trying to, again, try to be as open source as possible. So we have our recipe there, our fermentation kinetics of how the fermentation went, some of the parameters that we see of like attenuation rates, maybe diacetyl, gluten reduction, because we also add clarity firm. So, it's really crazy to see. I picked this alt beer because this is currently on tap, what I think is a nice variation between the two strains. Sometimes they're very slight nuance and you could pick up some things. One of the cool ones that we've done before too is our Taber IPA, our flagship IPA that we use 001, our California ale yeast, versus 008, our East Coast. And like one turns out like a West Coast IPA and the other turns like a hazy IPA.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, wow. Like you, yeah. Just that subtle difference of the yeast strain and you get two different
some
styles.
People don't believe you. It's like, what do you mean? This is the same beer with different yeast. Like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And they're like, no, you're lying.
No, no.
And that's like that light bulb moment that you're talking about. Then you're like, oh shit, like yeast is actually the star of the show in these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like sometimes the color changes, sometimes the mouthfeel completely changes. It's crazy. So
the aroma, of the interaction of specific strains of yeast with the same hops are different, right? Yeah, so even they can change aromas, right? IBUs, right? So there's so many things going on, right? That it can change completely.
So how would you guys recommend that we kind of start this tasting? Should we know which one's which or should we just start by kind of smelling and looking and, you know?
We know which one's which.
I don't. Yeah. I wasn't paying attention. That's per usual.
But yeah, I personally would do the blind route, like BJCP, and just, again, try to take it subjectively, look at all the things you would usually do for a regular beer tasting and see what comes out. Because a lot of times, right, there's a difference between tasting and just drinking.
Sure.
So it's fun to go through the motions of tasting.
Okay, they smell completely different.
Talk us through it, David.
Well, I do have some of the literature in front of me, so I'm going to try and ignore that as much as possible. But the one I have in my left hand is really, it's got a sweeter nose, like a dark fruit. And then the one I have in my right hand is far more caramel, toasty.
Toasty, bready.
Yeah, almost like a pepper in there. And that, if you had told me these were the same malt bill, I honestly would not have. Well, I would have believed you because you work at White Labs. But but if John told me, I definitely wouldn't believe him. So.
Accurate.
That is nuts.
All right, let's taste it.
All right, so was the one on the right the Kolsch?
The one on the right, the Kolsch.
I mean, the Kolsch yeast.
So Dusseldorf is the more malty one that usually comes out.
And then the one that we have on the left, the fruitier one, was your all's
Kolsch.
Okay. Yep. Excellent. That's incredibly interesting. Goodness gracious.
But yeah,
I need to start carrying Dusseldorf.
Right?
Excellent.
It's funny how like we could say certain flavor parameters and stuff, but again, until you brew with it, it's all subjective as well.
So. It's really funny because I guess I actually do use it usually on lighter beers. So I'm sure some of that fruity caramel is it playing with those darker roasted malts. But it's really funny that that's actually the, in my head, that's the flavor profile that I associate with your all's 029. But I got it completely wrong. That's the 3.6, right? Yeah.
And that's what happens, you know, many, many times here or in San Diego, you know, when you see brewers coming, you know, and drink their beers, it's like, oh, you know, they're like, they get ideas, right? Yeah. To write a recipe and, you know, what they like from, you know, one strain or the other. And that happens a lot, you know, like it's kind of cool to know that some brewers coming to our tap rooms are actually finishing or starting their, you know, recipes by, you know, tasting our beers.
A lot of the times too, when we're like developing recipes with people, we kind of call all of our recipes that we do in our shop like crowdsourced. Somebody will make it, somebody will tweak it, somebody else will make it, tweak it, da 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 da. So the wisdom of the crowds is what forms a lot of them. But sometimes when people are trying to like perfect something, they're like, oh, I think I'm going to switch to like Cascade from Columbus, or I think I'm going to add like, God help us, a little more caramel malt or something like that. But a lot of the times, just trying a different subtle yeast switch can actually get that thing that you're looking for. And this is actually an incredibly good example of that, just because of how different the expression is.
The contrast in these two is incredible. I mean, this is just straight like fruit to me, and there's maybe some biscuit too, but then the other one's just caramel. I mean, it's so malty.
Yeah, and that's always what we try to like say is with going off again with the breeds of dogs is they're so different. If you if that flavor style is not hitting what you want, change your yeast strain. And that's like the number one thing. Like, yes, you could optimize your health and how that fermentation of that yeast strain is to like fine tune some stuff. But if you're looking for something like that's not there, change that yeast strain.
Yeah, strain selection, right? It's first, right? Then, like he said, you can actually, you know, play around a little bit with temperature, pitch rate, right? Oxygen level, it's all about oxygen levels and such. But, you know, if you want that character, you need to go for that specific strain, right?
So I do have the literature in front of me, which is really altering this experience because the Dusseldorf with the higher Plato actually tastes drier to me.
I agree.
And that doesn't make sense.
Like, right? Yeah. Again, it goes off of like glycerol production. There's so many things that add to a beer that sometimes aren't monitored or parametered. But yeah, like it's crazy, right? Because let's finish at what?
4.3 for the Dusseldorf.
4.3.
And then the Kolsch.
2.8 for the Kolsch, which is dramatically different.
Yeah, the attenuation rates. But yeah, just the way it finishes and like the crispness and bitterness. I could totally see why the Dusseldorf seems like it finished lower.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I always think is fun. People ask a lot, like, "Well, how do I make my beer better? Like, how do I get this to be like better? What's the best beer? What's the best Kolsch?" It's all at the end of the day a matter of perception. So when you guys taste these side by side, you guys can maybe answer. I think I know, but do you guys have one that you prefer? Do you guys have one that you like better? Just as what you think if it's an alt beer in your head when you taste it.
My personal favorite is the 036. That's what I've been drinking on the menu currently. But yeah, what's funny is when we do our sensories for releasing these beers, sometimes it's split half and half of like, oh, half the people like 029, half the people like 036. And again, that's what tasting is. It's very subjective of what's a good beer.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about it in context of like alt beer, like which is the better like alt beer or more characteristic alt beer. I prefer the Kolsch yeast one. But yeah, if I had to think about like what exemplifies the alt beer style a little bit more, it would be the Dusseldorf.
Yeah.
And that's so cool about what you guys do, because as you said, then you get to talk to people about it. And instead of it just being your own opinion in your own head, you get to actually get people to, you know, use words that you can kind of then quantify. And then when a brewery has those questions, you can come back and be like, yeah, we wish our, you know, alt was a little bit fruitier, or we wish our alt was a little breadier. And you'd be like, oh, what cheese are you using? Like, et cetera, et cetera. That is super, super cool. And an experience everybody should have when you're in Asheville or at San Diego to take a trip to White Labs.
Yeah. And you guys have tasted thousands of beers before. There's monotony to it after a while. Just in this little exercise, I'm like, I pretty much forgot that it was an alt beer. I'm like, these are just two really different beers. Mm-hmm. So I feel kind of like a kid again because I'm like, yeah. I really don't care about the alt beer. I just wanted to, like, how the hell are these so different?
And I think that goes off of like some of my favorite beers that White Labs Brew Co. has made is it's when we throw in a yeast strain that's not to the style and it turns out something completely crazy and really good.
Yeah, you break the rules and then something else happens, right?
What was it? We did a hoppy lager, but with a 590, our French Saison. Mm-hmm. And it dried out this lager so well. And it was just essentially the hops. And like it was my favorite. And it's like, what style do I put this in? I can't put this in the style.
Yeah, the BJCP is like weeping right now.
Good. That's what this podcast is for.
I think we can all agree that these are great beers. And we can also agree that there's nothing more disappointing than tasting diastole in a beer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it seems that some recent news that I heard from you all that you all are getting rid of diastole. that's what's happening. You're just saying no more diastole.
From your mouth to God, Mueller.
Yeah. So you all recently released a new yeast that cuts down on that
enzyme.
It's an enzyme. Yeah. It's called ALDC. And it's an enzyme that, you know, what's their name?
It is called a Bruzyme D.
Bruzyme D.
It is an enzyme. So we actually took it from almost like another organism, but it's because it's able to reduce ALDC, which is alpha acetolactate, which is the precursor to diacetyl. So this enzyme is able to react on that precursor and convert it quickly versus the natural conversion of diacetyl is through the yeast. If you have healthy yeast, they'll naturally reconvert it. So all yeast strains produce diacetyl. It's just you're producing almost like amino acid, you're producing valine. So right, the workforce of life, you're producing all these different amino acids. So you're always gonna have alpha acetolactate in your beer. And as long as your yeast is healthy, it should reduce it. But if you want to speed up your timeline, have less fermentation tank time, you could add this enzyme in and it's going to act on this alpha acetolactate, this precursor, and then convert it to a flavorless compound. The only downside is if you add it too late of this enzyme, it's not going to work on diacetyl because diacetyl is always already there. So we say we recommend pitching this enzyme at the time of your yeast pitch, as well as time of dry hopping. Because also with dry hopping, you might have some additional fermentation happening. Mm. So anytime fermentation is happening, have this ALDC. And it quickens lagering time. It quickens fermentation take time. But yeah, a lot of yeast strains, as long as they're healthy, should reduce it. This is just cleaving off a couple extra days and making sure you don't have that worry. So less risk.
And that's not the only paving that you guys have done in the enzyme world. Just a few sentences about some of the other products that you guys put out, like Clarity Firm has been such a game changer for so many people in so many different ways. And then I think you guys did the version of, I see a lot of people make it now, but when Brut IPAs became a thing, I think that was you guys too, at least kind of
they should still
the
be
first
a thing.
Person I heard that from. Yeah. Those like, the what was
Ultra
that?
Firm,
beta glucose. Yeah. Yeah, the Ultra Firm, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Clarity Firm is, it's interesting. Like I have so many homebrewers, all sweaty at HomebrewCon, just giving me hugs and
yes, exactly.
thanking me. Then they were able to drink beer after I don't know how long. Because
and so for the listeners who don't know, Clarity Firm was originally designed as like a stabilizer, but what it also does is just break down gluten, mm-hmm. like not 100%. So it's not gluten free, but it gets it down under like 2 parts per billion or something.
Usually under 20, okay. as long as you do a proper dosage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you can just basically add it. I think you add it when you add your yeast, if I recall.
Yeah, it's meant for chill haze, okay. right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it, you know, we found that it reduces, you know, gluten too. Yeah.
So it reduces gluten to an amount that you said people are hugging you, like.
Yeah, well, the people who are like intolerant to gluten, and it depends on right. Everyone is different. They have different tolerances.
As you said, metabolic science is complicated.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's a matter of trying it, but many people who were not able to have beer because they will get sick using, Clarity Firm, they were now able to drink beer again.
That's awesome. You got a couple things in front of you. Pure Pitch, you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So I don't know if to say this is new anymore. It's been already there, but it's kind of newish, right? There's our new pouch, our what we call Pupich Next Generation. You know, and now it's all based more in a cell count, right? We wanted to give brewers, you know, kind of like, I don't know what's the best way of saying it. It's like pitch like a, the way I like to say it is like pitch like a pro brewer.
Yeah. Because right? Kind of back to what you were saying at the very beginning of the conversation, when we started homebrewing, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago or whatever, if you could find that little package of dry yeast on the shelf and you don't know its history, you don't know how long it's been sitting there, see, White Labs kind of led the way on innovating in that realm as well. Because I remember the old, like the old uninflated Coke bottle, like test tubes or whatever. And then you guys graduated to the, it's the positive pressure, like packaging system, which was, so I don't know. That's something you guys are always mindful of, but yeah, you were going there, but what is this express that's just different from the thing you would find on the shelf at Liquor Barn?
Well, you know, what we like to say is that, you know, like if you pitch one of these pouches in a 5 gallon, 20 liter, it will give you 7.5 million cells per mil, which is, you know, some people know as a Sierra Nevada pitch rate, right? You know, you can, it's up to what you want or the beer you're making, you know, you can go from, even you can go down to 7 million cells per mil. If you're making a Saison, let's say, right, you want to under pitch a little more, you can go to 10 million cells per mil or even higher for, you know, lagers. But, you know, this is a pitch rate that will give you, you know, what we call, you know, kind of like a, you know, like and a fermentation that will, you know, shouldn't cause any problems, right? Like, you know, even up to like higher, you know, Play-Dohs or high gravity, you know, beers, you know, this should be, it's the right pitch weight. So you have great fermentations.
So you're really bringing that like professional level ingredient to a homebrew.
Yeah. And it's been a little of a debate, right? Like, you know, I was a homebrewer too. And some homebrewers, you know, usually homebrewers talk in total cells, right? Like, how many cells are in that pouch? Right. And, I think that's important. It's good to know, but you know, when you go into the pro side of things, no one talks about how many cells you got in your pitch, in your, you know, what, how many cells you pitch in total. It's how many cells you have for that specific batch, for that word, right? And I think that's what it actually, what's important, because you need exact amount of cells or the amount of cells you need just to ferment that specific batch.
We'll occasionally do some like professional brews that like co-branded with us, and one of the first ones that I did several years ago was with JD Vasher over at Cumberland Brewing, and we're ready to pitch the yeast and he pulls out this microscope and I'm like, well, what are we doing? And he's like, well, we're gonna count. And I'm like, I can't count to
1 billion in one, 1 billion in two.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't, he's like, well, how much? And is it supposed to be there? He's like, 7 million. I'm like, dude, we don't have time for that. And he's like, no, like I'll show you, there's a method. I was like, well, what if it's like 10 million? What if we do too much? He's like, don't worry about it, it's fine. Like, we're gonna make it work.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite part about the next generation. Yes, it has more perforations. Yes, the viability is a lot better. But again, like what Pablo was saying is, we're taking that math, that scary math, and doing it for you. A lot of times my analogy is how people bake, right? A cup of flour is going to weigh different grammage every time you take a cup of flour. Mm-hmm. So it's not always by volume, because yeast cells are going to flocculate at different, the density is going to be different. So by cell counting, or just knowing how many cells you're pitching every time, you're going to get a more consistent fermentation because you're pitching by that unit. And if you overpitch, you won't get as much cell growth. You maybe not won't get as much beer flavor as we see here. So like by being more consistent on that unit of cell growth and like how many cells you're pitching, you're going to get hopefully less risk and more consistent fermentations.
Yeah. And you know what? It's really cool. And I said this again, because, you know, I still homebrew sometimes, and we all homebrewers, we all like geeks by choice.
and
we have a really cool calculator. You know, if you go to yeastman.com and the calculator, right, it will tell you, you know, you just put the temperature you're gonna ferment, right, your batch size, right, and the degree Play-Doh or, you know, starting gravity. and it will tell you how much we recommend to pitch, but also you can actually dial in. There's a little like a slide where you can actually, it will tell you the cells per mil and the cells per mil per degree Plato. And then you, if you want to really want to geek out, you can actually move that slider and go down or up in the cell count and choose the exactly cell count you want to pitch.
Yeah, that's actually really easy to find. So every pouch has a QR code, and it has, like what Pablo was saying, is our calculator, our yeast information. And then recently we added our estimated viability of like around what viability this pouch might be, just based off of almost like a generalized assumption of using our data of what we've taken over the years and being like, hey, based off this pouch, after 6 months, it's going to be around this viability.
Yeah, you see the QC report, yeah.
And one more thing you guys have recently launched that a lot of our customers have already, I think we got this in like 2 weeks ago, but you guys have started making dry yeast as well, which is really super cool to see. Because it like in a time when sometimes yeast can be a little bit hard to get, these have a lot longer shelf life and stuff. But talk us through just a little bit about how you guys developed and brought these dry strains to market.
Well, you know, it was, you know, like nowadays more and more people, you know, starting using more dry yeast and stuff. And I think one of the biggest thing was like, you know, there's some dry yeast out there that were like comparable to what people thought it was California ale, and it's actually not. So, you know, genetically they're different, right? So we wanted to, for people who wanted to start, for whatever reason, like you said, you know, you want to keep a few bricks there just in case, or it's easier for you, or you live in an area then it's too hot, right, during the summer, and so you don't trust, you know, shipping or blah, blah, blah. You know, you're able to use California because, you know, this is actually it's the first time, you know, this Cali ale, same as this one, is in dry form, right? So if you want to keep the same characteristics of the liquid WP01 in dry form, you know, this is the one.
Yeah, and my favorite part too is, again, like we always try to keep our products as cold as possible, ship to you on ice and everything, but there's always mishaps, you know, like you never know when there's going to be a strike or anything, but by having dry yeast, these ship better. There's 2 year shelf life. Again, we're trying to provide as many fermentation opportunities for the user as possible. So we're not saying we do love our dry yeast. We're always backing our our liquid yeast, but we try to get more options available. So we do have 001 California ale yeast in dry, as well as 066, our London Fog, our top selling hazy strain. And then we're also looking at a lager yeast to try. So again, we're just trying to provide as much opportunity as possible. And that's the bottom line is give people options.
Yeah. Usually what happening is like people still using the liquid, but they keep a few bricks.
For emergencies.
Yeah, I was about to say, oh shit, yeast. and it's there, you know, shelf life's great. And, you know, and you can have, you know, the same character on your beer.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for everything today. We don't want to take up too much more of your time. Is there anything coming up that you really want people to know about, though?
I know on my personal favorite that we're also trying to focus a lot more on is, again, just rekindling those connections, just providing options as much as possible. We are rekindling our customer club. So everyone remembers the customer club of turning the files and everything. We have a new group of fresh-eyed employees that we want to get that connection. So we just rebranded it to Fermentation Society, and we're releasing more and more strains in that bank. Again, going off that strain variety, getting new different strains out there. We want to hear feedback from you guys of what strains you want to play around with. Again, get that experimentation going. So Fermentation Society, we have whole new newsletters about interviewing homebrewers, interviewing retail stores, seeing what's happening even on our side of like our brewco of what beers we're brewing, what foods we're fermenting. So all our food actually in our pizza is actually WLP 518, our Opshug Hvike yeast. And it just adds this extra tanginess in pizza dough, right? It's not using regular baker's yeast. So just having that idea of like, hey, there's so many things that are fermented out there, coffee, chocolate, so many different things. And just having that fun mindset of like, hey, let's start experimenting. Let's start interacting with people. Going off those different strains, we also have like almost like a collect them all of like, we're releasing strains. I believe, yeah, like
bi-monthly or quarterly. But yeah, these specialty strains that we're taking out of the vault, we're also giving people pins every time you order, pre-order the strain. Cool. That's awesome. So it's going to be a collect them all. So talking about that 096 that we were talking about, we're actually going to release that. It's actually available to purchase right now with the pen, a pin. So WLP 096 freaking yeast blend. And I know currently for myself, I'm working with a Clawhammer Supply, a homebrew supply here in Asheville, to collab and release a new strain that they're looking for. So hopefully it's going to be all around lager yeast blend that is going to be the next strain for this exclusive release for Fermentation Society. So again, it's just another form of ways White Labs connect to the end user, to connect with homebrewers, and again, get that fun experimentation mindset.
How do I join?
So you could just go on yeastman.com, and there is a, once you create a profile, there's just a checkmark box of like, would you like to enroll with Fermentation Society? And that's how you get that communication going.
Very nice. Pablo, what do you got?
Just like, you know, like how we started talking, right? We, you know, just want to tell everyone, we a bunch of nerds and geeks, and we love beer. And that's what I think it's, we make the difference, right? Like we are here to help, right? And that's the whole thing. Sometimes like people are like, oh, you guys, White Labs so big, such a huge company. And we're not, you know, it's we're not that big, you know, and it's about like the passionate people who works here. Like, you know, like we here to help. We here, you know, like when people call you and, you know, we are there to help. And I think that's what it makes a big difference, right? Like as a consumer, right? The first thing you want is like calling and not being on hold for like forever. Mm-hmm. And so that's, and because we care, we want this industry to keep growing as much as possible. And that's what we're here for.
Awesome. John?
I'm just going to shout out tasting beer kind of mindfully, like we've been doing here today. We all kind of said what we thought maybe our favorites of these two were. I think I said that my favorite was actually the Dusseldorf. But now that I sit here and look at my glasses at the end of this podcast, I noticed by my sipping ratio that I've actually been sipping on the Kolsch a little bit more.
I agree. I like the Kolsch better.
I don't know. Yeah. What are your guys like poll results at the end of the podcast?
Kolsch.
Oh, he liked them both.
No, David drank them both. Yeah, that's good. And in addition to that, if you like these things, obviously come seek out White Labs, but wherever you are in the country, find your local homebrew club and go hang out with them too, because a lot of that stuff happens in real time and you can talk to the people who brewed it and made it. You've probably got a local homebrew supply shop close to you. We've been in business in our shop for 8 years. I've worked in another homebrew store for 4 or 5 years before that. White Labs has always been like the go-to yeast. You can get some stuff. There's a lot of companies out there that all make great stuff. But the reason I've always bought White Labs is just because of how consistent it is, how innovative it is, and that there's always something new to try as well. So yeah, White Labs is awesome.
David?
I'm going to play the Uno reverse card here. I don't have anything to plug, but I do have questions for you all.
Okay. So
you both travel. You're from San Diego, and Pablo, your territory. Are there any breweries that people should know about?
They're doing crazy stuff with White Labs.
I would say, in my opinion, I would say we have released, I don't know if you heard, Acid Trip. That it's a blend. Do you guys have you heard about Tripping Animals?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a brewery in Miami, and all the Carol Sours are done with a blend they kept for a long, long time. They don't even remember how they got it. But they make, you know, it makes, you know, really good base, you know, kettle sour beer. So one day I was visiting them and we start talking and say, hey, we want to do something with White Labs. And I was like, what about your, you know, this, you know, proprietary, whatever you want to call it. They didn't call it proprietary, but it's like, oh yeah, we would love to release it. So we got a sample, you know, send it to the lab. We saw what it was, and you know, we actually brew with it to see the, you know, the characters, the characteristics of this, and it was awesome. You know, like I personally brewed with it, and you know, it creates this like I would say like sour pineapple base. I'm honestly, I want to be 100% honest, I'm not really into kettle sour beers much. Mm-hmm. Somehow I get this grainy But this was like different. And I think it was kind of like the blend of different things going on in there. So we decided to, you know, release it. And yeah, it's called Acid Trip, right? and I think, you know, they're doing a great job. And, you know, I think that's something, I don't know.
Awesome. I'm going to take the easy answer here. And the reason why I stay with this community and everything is, again, how easygoing everyone is and how open everyone is. If you ever have a question or if you ever need to like borrow some, ask to use some of their equipment to test something or double check, such as a DO meter, ATP meter, everyone's open. So I always love stopping by breweries, making friends. That's what's great about this workshop too, is how many friends I've made throughout the years and just seeing them at CBC and just, again, rekindling that friendship. And that's what I love about this industry, is that wealth of knowledge and how everyone's hungry to learn more. And everyone understands, like, hey, there's always multiple ways to answer and learning those multiple ways.
And then finally, did yeast domesticate humans or did humans domesticate yeast?
Ooh, I do not know about that.
Who knows?
The gene sequence that has been the farthest away from the planet Earth, I think this shuttle has already launched, is yeast DNA. They put it into one of those like long-range satellites, shoot it out into space. It's going to come back in like 50 years, and they're going to analyze what the radiation in deep space did to the genome. And just because, you know, the yeast genome is one of the ones we've been working with the longest. So my argument is that if evolution means just spreading your DNA as far and wide as you can, yeast domesticated humans. They got us to work for them and shoot their DNA off way into outer space.
We could be yeast, actually, because the family tree, we're closer.
We could be yeast. We're
closer to yeast than lactobacillus, so, like bacteria. So we could be yeast.
So, know? Okay, now I'm imagining like an episode of This Is Us, except instead of mushrooms, it's yeast. okay, on my end, I'd like just to plug you all, specifically the pizza here. The pizza here in this restaurant that you all have in Asheville, just stop by on your next visit because it is great pizza. You know, like you said earlier, the Quebec yeast was used for the crust. It's so good. Stop by, have some beers, say hi, and enjoy some pizza.
Yeah, and I think it comes to flavors, right? And at one point, you know, society just wanted things fast and didn't care about flavors. And, you know, yes, it takes a little longer to make a pizza dough with brewer's yeast, but the flavor's there, right? So I think it's that's what it matters. Not how fast you do it, not how easy it is. It's what better product, final product is.
That's pretty much everything in life. Yep. So with that, thank you all so much. Thanks for inviting us into your lab today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you again.